Good afternoon and welcome to The Aware Show. Hi, this is Lisa Garr joining you this wonderful afternoon with a very special surprise in store for you today. I am blessed by the presence of Swami Kriyananda once again in my studio for the last time, who has been here for 6 months in Los Angeles. He is one of the few remaining direct disciples of the famous spiritual leader Paramahansa Yogananda. He is the founder of Ananda Los Angeles Spiritual Center and of Ananda Worldwide, one of the world's foremost experts on meditation and yoga, spiritual practice, and is quite a musician in your own right and composed over 400 pieces of music, right? Yes. Well, welcome to the show. Thanks for being back here with me again.
Thank you for inviting me.
I said we're getting to be regulars. You're going to be regular on my show here. I love it. And I love having you here because you and the wonderful people that come with you are so grounded and loving. And I feel like I'm surrounded by a big, huge bouquet of roses. It's beautiful energy. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm sure the people listening can hear that joy in my life because I really love having you around and I love having, you can hear the joy in my voice. So you had been on my show, a couple of months ago, and you were talking about the reason that you specifically came to Los Angeles.
Well, it's because what Yogananda also said, he felt that Yogananda is the Benares of America. Benares is the holy city of the Hindus in India. And the reason for that feeling is that it was populated a long time ago, not in the time of the Red Indians or anything. It was a very high civilization and a very spiritual one. And that has left its power in the soil here. Beneath all the frenetic energy of modern-day Los Angeles, there is a spiritual power. And because of that, you find a lot of spiritual interest here. And many people in America sort of laugh at Los Angeles for its spiritual folly.
The New Age,
But I say people show their folly in the things they're interested in. At least they have that interest here.
It is very interesting that Los Angeles does coagulate spiritual centers and people come here to do lectures and seminars. And Los Angeles is a bit of a spiritual mecca, which is one of the reasons why this radio show is so popular here. And the whole afternoon programming here at KPFK, which is so awesome that they took this type of programming on.
Well, that's exactly right.
So this is why it works.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. What about when people, well, let's go back further a little bit, when you said before the American Indians.
I mean that they weren't the Native Americans. Native Americans go back for thousands and thousands of years into other cultures.
Yes.
We also are Native Americans if we were born here.
And I
wouldn't put ourselves down that way. But in fact, this high civilization had many great spiritual masters living. And they've created that kind of magnetism which people feel. When you get off the plane, you feel something in the air here.
What is that feeling, though? There's a combination in when you get off the plane in Los Angeles of a super high-frequency energy, chaos, and then there's the spiritual. I mean, what is it?
I feel this deep calmness. Underneath all the chaos, all the noise, there's this deep spiritual vibration of peace and upliftment.
You feel that?
Yes.
You do, but you also hear the chaos.
Oh, yeah.
How do you hear that calmness underneath it all?
I can't explain how I feel it, but I do feel it.
You do. When you were here with Paramahansa Yogananda in Los Angeles, what were your experiences like here in Los Angeles?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to answer a question like that.
It's a big one.
Yeah. I have to say that now it's as if there were two streams separated, one going toward more and more worldliness, another one going toward spiritual hunger and truth. I find the people who come to my talks, there's much more interest in spirituality now than there was then.
Really?
And my audiences, because he had me lecturing very soon after I came to him, they were mostly people over 40. Now there are a lot of young people.
And this was in the 60s, yes?
This was in the 49. Yeah.
My goodness.
He had me lecture. My first lecture was when I was 22.
Wow.
I'd never lectured before, but anyway.
And was that, how did that go, by the way?
I think everybody was gracious.
I remember you telling me stories. Also joining us on the phone is Asha Praver. She is the director, along with her husband, of Ananda in Palo Alto. Hi, Asha. How are you?
Hello, Lisa. I'm very well. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. I'm glad to have you here. Asha has a wonderful perspective, who has traveled with Swami Kriyananda for a while and has been able to see some of the experiences that people have had as a result of Swami Kriyananda's impact in this world and in your life. And I know that you, Swami, have a humbleness about you, that you're not really going to tell me the stories of the miracles that have happened to the people around you because of your innate humbleness. And I respect that.
So that's your trick, I see.
Yes, it is, because you deserve to be honored.
Okay.
Yes. And I know that you have made an incredible impact on people's lives, and so many, the hundreds and thousands of people who have followed your work and who know and love you. I receive so many emails and comments after you're on the show.
Hmm.
It's beautiful. But you're not going to tell me about it.
No, I'm not, because I don't really feel like this.
Exactly. My point, exactly. And I appreciate and respect that.
Okay.
So Asha is also joining us so that she could share with us some of the impact that Swami Kriyananda has had here. So in the beginning, when you founded Ananda up in Palo Alto, Asha, can you tell me a little bit about that experience and how you came to meet Swami Kriyananda and the whole organization?
Well, I have to go back a little while. I met Swami Kriyananda in 1969. I was, as it happened, 22 years old, and I lived in Palo Alto, and he was invited to give a lecture at Stanford University. And I had been a Stanford student, but no longer, and I went to hear him, and I have to say that it was his presence that spoke to me before he spoke. I was already a student of self-realization, of expanded Eastern kind of teachings, but I had never seen a living example of the principles that I was studying. And when he came into the room where he was to give his lecture, I sensed in his consciousness the kind of freedom and bliss that I'd been reading about but had never experienced. And something in his consciousness touched mine immediately. And then he spoke. And after he spoke, I thought I actually thought he was the most intelligent man I'd ever heard speak. But my commitment to him actually came from his consciousness before I even heard what he had to say.
Amazing. So the teachings precede you, and the energy that you bring into a room precedes you, which I'm sure that you've heard before. Now, they are making a movie of your life, Swami Kriyananda.
They seem to be, yes.
So can you tell me a little bit about the movie? And Asha, please chime in.
It's going to be a docudrama. And
we have a camera here in studio right now.
They've interviewed me, and I spent quite a few hours talking about different parts of my life and so on. I was born in Romania of American parents, and I've been sort of an outsider all my life. I was an outsider in Romania. I went to school in Switzerland. I went to school in England. Then we moved here. We came for a vacation in 1939, and we were about to go back when Germany invaded Poland. So this was 1939, and so we stayed here. So what am I to say?
How did you meet Paramahansa Yogananda?
Okay, well, that was a very important thing. I had been seeking truth all my life, and I met him through reading his book, Autobiography of a Yogi, and that just completely floored me. I took the next bus across the country from New York to Los Angeles. And the first words I said to him were, "I want to be your disciple." And he accepted me, and I've been that now for nearly 63 years.
But But there was not just a simple yes. There was a connection of many, many, many lifetimes together that you experienced.
Well, I suppose so, but I didn't believe in reincarnation.
At the time.
Well, I certainly believed it because he believed in it, but I had argued against it before meeting him.
Well, I'm sure he saw it further and deeper than...
Yes, he said so.
He said so. What did he say to you?
Pardon?
What did he say to you?
He said to me, you have good karma, and I will give you my unconditional love, and will you give me yours? And I said, yes. He said, will you give me your unconditional obedience? And I had to be truthful. And so I said, how can I give you my unconditional obedience? What if I ever think you're wrong? And he said, I will never ask anything of you that God does not tell me to ask you. So I said, in that case, yes, I give you my unconditional obedience.
And you have been teaching since then. Asha, now you, when you met Swami Kriyananda, and you went to you took it another step into your life after you went to the lectures and you experienced now being one of the directors of one of the Ananda communities. You know what? I have to explain for the listeners that didn't hear you before on the show what the Ananda communities are, and if you could, Asha, explain that a little bit to us.
Well, one of the ideals of Paramahansa Yogananda when he came to America was to form communities, spiritual communities, that would be not only for monks and nuns, but for householders and single people, where people could marry and raise children in a more or less, quote, normal environment. But it would all be God-centered, and everybody who would live there would have a priority to meditate and to be attuned to God and to serve God. And it was an ideal Yogananda himself was not able to fulfill, but he set the template, and Swami Kriyananda, as his disciple, has picked that up and has created 8 of these communities, and I, as one of Swami Kriyananda's students, and through him, a disciple of Yogananda, have been able to carry out that ideal through the development of the Ananda community in Palo Alto, where we have a temple, a school for children, a couple of businesses, and a residential community as well. So we set up in an urban atmosphere this opportunity for people to live in uplifting spiritual company, but not necessarily separate themselves from the life that they're more accustomed to living. And I took that responsibility on at Swami Kriyananda's request after some 15 years of being part of the original community that Swami was founding in 1969 when I first met him.
Asha was my secretary.
Great.
But I had to let go of her. I saw she had too much talent just to be a secretary.
Mm-hmm. And so she's now a director of one of the Ananda communities.
Yeah.
That was a difference of opinion between us. Word on it.
You, I'm sure you have, and by the way, I want to open up the phones to callers in just a little bit. So as you're listening, you can give us a call at 818-985-5735. And Swami Kriyananda is here in studio, as well as Asha Praver on the phone, and I am would love to take your calls in a little bit. Again, the number is 818-985-5735. Now, I want to ask you, Asha, as you've traveled and had your experiences with Swami Kriyananda, what have you seen in terms of his impact on either individuals or even miracles that you've witnessed that have occurred in his presence?
Well, it's very interesting because when Swami Kriyananda talks about Master Paramhansa Yogananda, he describes him as a perfect human being. I mean, not only this overarching consciousness, but also this ability to relate completely appropriately with absolute sensitivity in all circumstances. And my experiences with Swami Kriyananda over these 40 years have been this remarkable observation of right behavior. Right behavior not in the sense of social custom only or even particularly, but a sensitivity to the needs of others that never fails to perceive what people need and how to deliver it, whether that's a merchant in Goa, India, or myself in the middle of a personal crisis or some other devotee of Ananda. In fact, from the first moment I met Swamiji, I felt that As a direct disciple of Yogananda, his life was and would be of great significance, and I felt from the beginning that my duty was not only to experience it myself, but to record and share with others. So I've published a book of such stories, all firsthand accounts of both miraculous and ordinary things that happen.
That's great. I'm so glad that you did that, and it goes along with the documentary that's being made of his work. So could you share a few of your favorite stories with us?
Oh, certainly. I'll give you two extremes of favorite stories. One was the story of a man who'd been sick for many months and was plagued with 6 months of continuous coughing. And he had the opportunity to see Swami Kriyananda after Swami Kriyananda's long absence. But he was reluctant to impose himself there because of this continuous cough. And Swami Kriyananda heard that he was waiting upstairs and wasn't going to come visit him. And Swami just said emphatically, "But he doesn't have a cough," just like that. And in that moment, the man found that his coughing symptom absolutely disappeared and did not return.
Do you remember the story?
I don't.
You don't?
Oh. No.
It's great. See, Asha, why you're here.
He remembers from reading it in my book.
Asha has a good memory.
Love it. I love it. Yes.
I took notes at the time.
That's in your experience, from what you saw, was it an energy transmission that was given to the man with the cough, Asha, or was it just permission, or was it just, do you know?
I think it was all of those things. There was a receptivity on the part of the man. Mm-hmm. I think that Swami Kriyananda has been a truth teller his whole life, and the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras say, if you always speak the truth, your words have a materializing effect on the universe.
Mm.
I think that was also part of it.
That's a wonderful teaching, yes.
I think there's a certain amount of transference of karma, that the karma is fulfilled, and then the moment comes when it's done, that Swamiji, with his energy, sort of finishes the karmic cycle in a certain way, helps us through it.
Do you do that intentionally, Swami?
You know, you're asking me a field that I don't know anything about.
Oh, is that possible?
Lisa, see, this is part of the mystery of it. People don't understand how a truly spiritual person works. We tend to think that a truly spiritual person is an egoist on just a massive scale.
I have seen many.
Yeah, who go around and sort of impose their will on everyone.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What they fail to understand is that the more spiritually advanced a person becomes, the more they live completely unselfconsciously in the greater ocean of spirit.
Well, if these things are brought to my attention, I do my best to forget them quickly.
And just be grateful.
Yeah.
I noticed that, and I've seen that in you when I've been talking with you, because the essence that comes through you is absolute joy and happiness. And when you say you feel you don't exist.
Yeah.
Explain
he is
that.
The only reality. God is the only reality. We have to get rid of our egos if we want to become one with him.
Yeah, exactly.
And he says this with a smile, ear to ear. I love the presence. So, Asha, you were going to tell us another story, and thank you so much, because this is providing a teaching and just lessons for people as you're listening in to get the essence of the body of work that comes from generations of healers. It is a wonderful experience to especially be present with you, Swami Kriyananda, because you are 100% present in every word that you speak. And I love that about you, because you're always right here with me. You listen to every word. You answer it with the heart. And even if it's a ridiculous question, you stay with me on it.
I've never noticed you asking anything ridiculous.
I know. You're wonderful. Asha, could you share with us a couple of your other favorite stories of your experience with Swami Kriyananda?
Well, I have tried to write about Swamiji in such a way that we can not only admire him, but also understand how to be. Here's another example. And you'll hear that this is mundane, but you'll see also there's real-life teaching here. Swami Kriyananda went out to dinner with a friend who was also a business associate. This was in Europe, and a man from Ananda. Swami and the man and this other couple went out, and After dinner was over, Swami's companion said to him after the couple had gone home, he said, "Oh, the negativity between that couple was so thick you could cut it with a knife." And Swamiji's response was it? I didn't notice.
Hmm.
And then, however, as he reflected on it, he realized that every response he'd made to either the man or the woman of the couple was an attempt to uplift their consciousness, to get them to see the positive side, and to create harmony between them. But he never bothered to cognize their reality as negative. He just intuitively thought, without even conscious thought, how can I help them? And then responded from that natural willingness to be an instrument for upliftment.
Well, I do remember that one.
You do?
Yeah.
And
yeah, there's another story. I think miracles come from God. I admit that our magnetism has something to draw them, but this was on a Sunday morning, and I had the service to give at 11 o'clock. At 9, I got a kidney stone attack. It was so severe, my whole body was shaking with the pain. And I don't like to pray for myself, so I didn't. But I was in great pain, and after about quarter to 11, I finally said to God, whom I think of as my Divine Mother, I said, "If you want me to give this service, you're going to have to do something about this pain." In the length of time it takes to take one breath, it vanished. And it was replaced by such a joy, I could hardly speak anyway.
See, now that's a story you wouldn't have known, Asha, because you probably have this happened in a minute in your own present, in your own space, right? That's wonderful. And you just said something so powerful. You said, miracles meet magnetism.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Why do miracles occur to people who are close to God? They have the magnetism to attract them also. So it's a two-way thing.
So how could we use this in our own healing?
If you have an absolutely positive attitude, you can get well. I remember before I came on the path, I was in the hospital in Mexico City, and I had streptococcus, tonsillitis, dysentery, all sorts of things.
Wow.
I had seen the doctor only when I was well enough to go see him. Mm. Until then, I was worse. And he told me, "You must forget about leaving here before 2 weeks." And I made a few discreet inquiries as to how much it would cost. And they told me that it would be a sum far more than the money that I had. So I just said, "I have to get out of here." In 2 days, I was well.
So you decided.
So that's what I'm talking about. We have to have the willpower, the positive thinking, and then these higher powers come into effect to uplift us.
Have you have a spiritual practice yourself? Do you, when you get up in the morning?
Naturally, we have Kriya Yoga. We have meditation, thought of God, sharing our every waking moment with Him, all of that.
And that's what your day is like. As you now, when you get up and you have those your time and your meditation, and then you have to get in the car and travel to here or the studio or various places where you come into this particular energy in Los Angeles, to the traffic, to the sirens, to the chaos. How do you then? You're not in resistance to it, are you?
No, you have to be with it. You I had a very interesting experience, because when I was building Ananda, it required a great deal of work on my part. I had to raise all the money.
Mm.
And I gave it by giving classes in a different city every night. One night I came to my parents' home in Atherton, and I was going to rest there before I went out and gave another class. And my mother said, "You've just got to stop punishing yourself. You can't do all this." I was just really exhausted. So I went to my room and I lay down and I thought of all the things that were exhausting me. All the classes, all the telephone calls, all the letters, all the demands on my time and so on. And each time one of those thoughts came, I was a sense of resistance to it. And I said, "No, it's a part of your life now. You have to accept it." So the energy came back to me. And by the time half an hour of this was over, I felt full of energy. And my mother said, "You've had such a good sleep." I hadn't slept. But it was the best class on, it was on energization. Maybe the best one I ever gave.
You know what? That is a wonderful, wonderful lesson. I've had the same experience of demands on my time, but I've been struggling with this in my own mind because I'm the one that says yes to the things that take the demand on my time.
Then you have to say yes further.
To the energy of it.
Yeah.
Yes further, meaning yes, this is my path, this is
yes,
my choice.
I accept it.
I got it.
Not only that I have to do it, but I accept it.
And I get to do it.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's exciting for me because of what I do and to meet wonderful people like you and still raise my family and, you know, experience this. It's all the same energy.
Yeah.
It just, yes, I completely understand it. Asha, and I thank you so much for being with us on the phone here. Could you share some other stories with us? I love storytelling. It's an ancient art and radio is a wonderful place for it. So if you wouldn't mind, we could create all sorts of mental image pictures around all these stories you're telling us.
I don't mind at all.
Thank you.
My favorite subject.
Great.
When I met Swamiji, as I mentioned, I was 22. By the time I was 24, 25, as he said, I was working for him and worked pretty closely with him until we moved to Palo Alto in 87. Anyway, I've been in regular contact with him, and I grew older. 40 years have passed, and I've come into a leadership position, and I'm old enough now where people are now 20-some years younger than me, as I'm 21 years younger than
me. Love it.
He's been correcting me and I for all the years of my life.
Really?
And I never learn it.
Which is great. Okay.
Anyway, I'm completely flummoxed now. People are younger, and they're 20 years younger than I am now.
Yeah.
And in any case, but because I suddenly have to work with younger people who have less experience in many cases, and I'm often tempted to just say, "You're young. You don't know what you're doing. Listen to me." But I remember, because everything that I do, I model myself on what I learned from Swamiji because I admire it so much, I realized that in all the years I worked for Swamiji, really not once did he ever refer either to my age or inexperience. And believe me, I gave him plenty of cause, but he never did. So when I went to thank him for that, I said, because I realized it later, 20 years later, I said, "Swamiji, you never once in all those years, no matter how, you know, callow my thoughts were, you never once referred to my age or inexperience, and you just respected me so much. I'm so grateful. It was so helpful." Swamiji accepted my thanks graciously, but then he looked at me and he said, "Asha, I never noticed. I never think of anyone according to the age of their body, because everyone is an eternal soul. Age of the body is just an illusion."
Yeah.
And what I appreciated when he told me that was not only the wisdom of that way of approaching life, but the extent to which what I sometimes perceive as right attitude or affirmation on his part is actually a state of consciousness.
Mm.
And it helps me understand that we can take these learnings much deeper than we think.
This one, and Swami Kriyananda, you're in your 80s now, yes?
I'll be 85 in a couple of months.
85, wonderful. And and your energy and your enthusiasm is a testament in itself of you not paying attention to that chronological age. But not that that's even old, looking at, you know, you and your youthfulness and your vibrance and your energy.
One thing I can't understand is why my voice has suddenly become so deep.
That's right. That's right. It has. It's getting increasingly deeper as you go along. So if you could share with us some of the teachings that you teach around stress and around the cycle of stress that we have. I'm talking particularly in Los Angeles and so forth, that we have a stressful lifestyle.
Well, we've been talking about that. We've said that we have to accept
the stress.
We have to be centered in ourselves. We haven't said that. That's very important. Don't let anybody shake you from that inner balance. This is the secret of Kriya Yoga, too. You get centered in your spine, and everything proceeds from that. So if you see a beautiful sunset, You don't jump up and down the way people do in TV advertising.
Right.
You become centered in yourself, and you know that this is where you're really experiencing the happiness. Not out there, but here. When you react to anything, it's a reaction to it. Things are neutral. But whether they're good or bad depends on your reaction. So if you can be centered in yourself, you can understand that the reaction really is something inside. If you can do that, you can turn that reaction toward the positive.
How do you take that, and I've noticed in the stories that Asha is talking about and your experiences, you don't have resistance to things. You don't appear to push against anything. How do you feel, or can you offer us some different perspectives on looking at things like world hunger and child prostitution and war and death due to war?
You know, this is something that Thoreau said. Was it Thoreau? I think so. And that if you see wrong in the world, you should do something about it. Well, the fact is, if you see one wrong, okay. If you see a million wrongs, what are you going to do? You just have to accept that this world is full of wrongs. Do your little bit, and that's the most you can do. I've never allowed anything to get my peace of mind, to shake me from my inner center. So if there's a very important project, if it's pushed me too far, I say no. I won't do it.
Well, you have. I mean, when you were starting the Ananda centers and so forth, you had to push against a lot of resistance.
Oh, I did.
Yeah. And you were a stand for what you believed in and the work of Paramahansa Yogananda that you were carrying out.
Yeah.
And people who listen to the station, strong activists for peace, and they do wonderful things in being an activist and help.
I believe in that, mm-hmm. But don't get peaceless in your peace campaigning for peace. If you're going to campaign for peace, campaign with peace
in your heart to start in terms of the peace.
Yeah, it's very important to be concerned, but we have to be practically concerned. Don't get angry. You won't help anything by anger. Do what you can in a positive way.
Now, I was watching a video the other day, and it was talking about how we are, as a society, tend to be separatists, and where we are in a lot of competition with being first, or our way is better, and so forth, and that a lot of social and society and media and so forth puts it in that us in that better-than-you separatist perspective. Now, in terms of world religions and various religions that are operating here in Los Angeles, since we're talking specifically about Los Angeles on this show, how do you suggest to people to bring those various different religious perspectives together?
If we can understand, I've been at and participated in religious congresses. And I remember there was one in Calcutta, and the Catholic Monsignor Bishop or whatever got up and said, "Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about my Lord Jesus Christ." And each one was talking about his thing. I said, when I got up, I said, "Why do we talk about our own specific thing in such a way as to define it separately from any other?" Mm-hmm. And so I said, "Let's talk about what we have in common." And people were saying, "Well, that's amazing. That's wonderful." To me, it was not amazing or wonderful. It was obvious.
Mm-hmm. And what is that? What is it that we have in common?
Okay, the basic thing in religion is we are all seeking God. That's a good beginning. You can call him Brahma. You can call him Allah. You can call him anything you like. Jehovah, it doesn't matter. It's that one higher reality in all our lives. And if we understand that the closer we are to that reality, the more we will have of what we want. That's enough.
When you've heard that phrase, we create our own reality, have you heard this phrase?
I've heard it, and it's certainly true on a certain level. You can't create the universe.
Right.
But you can create your own reactions.
Different than reality. Is that where the miracles and the magnetism comes into play?
I think partly there. Not entirely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when we create our own reality, we create part of it, and the rest of it is divine?
Well, we're living in a greater reality. We're dreaming, but we're a part of a greater dream. It's God's dream.
Explain that, we're dreaming.
God, well, we dream our lives. We think of ourselves as men or as women. Our bodies tell us that we're that. We think that we have certain ambitions, certain desires. Those are our personal dream. Whole societies dream in a particular way at any time in history. But there is a broader dream which created this earth, created these people, created this universe. All of it came out of the consciousness of God. And he dreamed everything into existence. Nothing is real except as a part of his dream.
So when we have pain in our bodies, is that a nightmare?
Well, when I go to the dentist, for example, I don't take Novocaine. I just won't think about the pain. It's not that the pain doesn't exist, but I ignore it. I put my mind on some music I want to compose, some book that I'm writing. One time the pain was greater than usual, and I just sort of expanded my consciousness and felt that I'm much larger than this little body, and so I won't let this little body affect me. And the dentist was standing there with his perspiration flowing down his forehead, but I didn't feel anything. I felt it, but it didn't bother me.
He was in a lot more pain than you were, probably. Yeah. Asha, have you seen or experienced healings that Swami has not given, but given a person a permission to do, essentially?
You mean that others have then healed in his name? Is that
yes.
The question you're asking?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, healing can take place in two different ways. One is the dramatic cessation of symptoms, which I have observed in others. It's never been offered to me. I haven't needed it. Or what Swami described God gave to him. The other healing, though, that is of a more lasting value is the healing of misunderstanding in the consciousness that causes people to be sad.
Interesting, yes.
And that's the kind of healing that Swamiji has done continuously and effortlessly, and in many ways is the most important, because then it gives all of us the power to keep our consciousness where we want it to be.
The healing of disconnection.
Of disconnection, of misunderstanding, mm-hmm. Of all these things. You were talking about the great troubles that take place on this earth. I know when a group came and wanted Swamiji's to put Ananda's support behind one such movement. It was a valid movement. But the presentation, first of all, was entirely fear-based. If we don't change these things, then all these people will die. Swami's response was kindly but very blunt. He said, first of all, he said, look, 100 years from now, almost everyone on this planet is not going to be on the planet anymore. And whether we all die slowly over the next century or go out in one big bang, he said, what difference will it make when we're in the astral world? It won't matter. And then he kindly said what he said here, which is, if you really want to bring peace, you can't do it by inculcating fear in people, because fear is what causes peacelessness in the first place. Mm-hmm. Then he added, he said, if everyone lived, as he put it, as we do at Ananda, we wouldn't have any of these problems. And what he means by that is, all of these difficulties are caused by people are out of touch with their own inner reality, their divine reality. And the more people become in harmony with themselves, the more everything in the world also comes into harmony with that.
Yes.
So it's a very social activist way to be. And that's the sort of constant vibration that emanates both from his person, from his writings, from his lectures, from his music, that brings people slowly into a greater sense of where I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to do and how I can be in harmony with God while doing it.
And, you know, I understand that perspective, and it does help when you live in a community where everyone in your community is also understanding that perspective. And for those of us that don't live in that type of a community where we still have struggles and life situations that occur and competition and some cases meanness and those types of things that happen, I guess the best thing to do is to find our own spiritual practice and our own temple of our mind or lives or family. Is that the solution if we don't live in a community like that? And I'm asking Swami.
Certainly it helps to be, at least have surround yourself with good friends. I would consider the company you keep one of the most important aspects of your life. If there are people in your life who pull you down, shun them like poison. Shun them like a disease. They will hurt you. Try to be with people who will have an uplifting influence. You can create your own community right where you live.
Well, what if it's
your
own...
If you make good friends.
What if it's your family members that are the ones that tend to be toxic, like relatives?
They have in England the expression, send them to Coventry, which means just don't talk to them too much.
Mm, so just, and then again, as you said, be out of resistance too,
yeah,
to what they're doing. A lot of the spiritual practices and books and so forth that are written these days are written about empowering our own mind. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about the idea of empowering ourselves on our own mind?
I think that there's a lot of truth and a lot of error in it. The truth is that it's certainly necessary. The error is if you make it ego-centered. If you think, I am more powerful, I am this, I am that, you become very self-centered, and that is the source of all people's trouble and suffering, consciousness of ego. Mm. So if you can become empowered, but understand that that power is not yours, that it's from a higher source, then there's no limit to what you can do. And we have to have power. We can't go through life being wimps and get anywhere.
Right.
So I completely agree with it. It's just the emphasis on I that I haven't liked.
Yes, I was interested in your perspective about that. And also about, I've heard it said that the one of the quickest ways to self-healing is by helping others.
You know, when people in the family are ill, father is in bed, the children are in bed, the mother isn't in bed. Mm. When the father goes back to his office, the children go back to school, the mother finally gets ill. Mm. But she doesn't as long as she's helping. So the more we help other people, the less likely we are to be affected.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful, that's a wonderful story. That's a great example.
Yeah.
So your last day in Los Angeles is today. Where do you go from here?
I go back to our community in near Nevada City, California.
Okay. Up in northern area.
And
what's next for you in terms of books or just rest, or is it travel?
Well, you know, they're making movies of, one is the life of Yogananda, another one is of my life, and I have to be involved in those.
Yes, yes.
So they'll be coming up there to film, I'll be coming down here to do different things and so on.
Okay, you're going back and forth. And Asha, in what is the name of your book, by the way, that has this?
It's called Swami Kriyananda As We Have Known Him.
Wonderful. And what was your intention with writing that book?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I felt really from the first I met Swamiji very soon after that I was witnessing a remarkable person and that my experiences were not meant for me alone. He's a great master, a great disciple of a great master, and he's done a great deal to really make Yogananda's teaching accessible and practical and understandable in a very broad way through all the books and work that he's done. And I felt that his own life manifests both discipleship and divine attunement in such a grounded, balanced way that it seemed important to me to communicate that because we learn from the examples of others. And so that was my intention in writing.
I have to say, quite impersonally, it's a good book.
Well, I understand. Can you tell me, one of the callers is asking about your perspective on death.
On death?
Yeah.
Well, really, I think the best thing about old age is the knowledge that it's temporary.
Old age is temporary because...
I'm not afraid of death. Life goes on. Consciousness goes on.
What about when you have a death of a loved one?
They will be... If there's real love there, you will meet again. You know, here I was born in Romania. My guru is in Los Angeles. I was attracted to him when it was right for me to meet him. I came. Mm-hmm. And this happens. We are drawn to, love is a magnet, and it draws people together, even from opposite sides of the earth. Those who have a deep bond of love, they never lose that. And I should add to that, hatred also is a bond.
Oh, interesting.
And sometimes you find people born in the same family who hated each other.
Wow.
In a position where now they can fight it out at close quarters.
So they don't bother anyone else with it. Very interesting. Very interesting. Asha, could you share with us a few more stories from your book of experiences that you've seen or the impact that Swami Kriyananda has made on people's lives?
Certainly. I can give you an example of my own. Once when I was facing a very difficult test, I had great confusion in my life. I had to make a decision, and I felt very sorry for myself in my confusion, and I went to speak to Swamiji, and I became very melodramatic about my desire to do what God wanted me to do. And I said, oh, it's so hard to know what God wants. And then I burst into tears. It was very dramatic. And Swamiji looked at me very calmly, but quite impersonally. And I had said, it's so hard to know what God wants. And he says, no, it's not. Just like that. And then there was really no more conversation. And I was not at all satisfied, but I could tell that there was nothing more forthcoming. So right. I left and I went home. And I was meditating afterwards, and I thought to myself, well, it's really hard for me to know what God wants. And so I prayed on that subject, and as soon as I prayed, I could sort of feel Swamiji's voice answering me. And the answer was, well, you don't really want to know what God wants. And I sort of wanted to say, yes, I do, yes, I do. But I could feel his consciousness saying, you're afraid to know. And then I thought to myself, well, what am I afraid of? Then suddenly the whole situation I was dealing with went into a completely different perspective, because I realized that what I was doing was I was avoiding what I was afraid of by pretending that I was just confused.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, I changed my prayer to, instead of what does God want, I asked, what am I afraid of?
Mm.
And when I went back to Swamiji shortly after, and I said, sir, it seems to me that whenever I'm confused about God's will, it's because my fear is blocking my intuition. He said, yes. And I said, so if I'm not afraid, then I'll be able to understand. He said, yes. And then he said, again, it's not hard to know what God wants. And in another context, I noticed, as I mentioned earlier when I first met Swamiji, his insightful intelligence was very impressive to me. And I became very interested over the years in how he could be so insightful. And the people around him were quite bright, but he could always find an answer, and even when others of us were stumped. And I began to realize that the intelligence of his mind came from the courage of his heart, because his heart is entirely committed to the simple truth. And it's the feeling that agitates the mind, and that he had a characteristic posture, especially when he was younger, where he essentially would meet life heart first. And that desire for the truth is what gives us clarity of mind. And so I've always known, remembered ever since then, whenever I can feel confused, I ask myself, what am I afraid of? And I pray to God instead, not what do you want, but help me to overcome my fear. And then guidance, if not instantaneous, is at least not so unattainable as it was before that.
So this is a great conversation around purpose as well. If someone were to have a purpose that they don't know about yet, or they're confused or what their purpose is, or feel like they're off path and off purpose, that's a wonderful example of how to be still. And sometimes I notice that your teachings come through your silence, Swami Kriyananda. Your silence allows people permission to really hear themselves in the chatter, and then to really contemplate what it is that they're really asking. So you, Asha, were able to change your question about yourself, which is a great example. You, Swami Kriyananda, teach the art of happiness. The art of happiness. What a wonderful title. The art of happiness. Happiness is an art form, yes? in your perspective?
I suppose that's the best way to put it, yes.
And how do you achieve that wonderful art of happiness?
Honestly, the more you feel of God in your heart, the more you have happiness. The fewer desires you have, the fewer attachments, the more you look to other people and other things to make you happy, the more you discover that your energy comes back to yourself. The more you discover, well, I am happy. I'm not only happy, I am happiness.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, especially the city, Los Angeles, is a very materialistic society, and we're marketed to all day long about our possessions and attachments to every other commercial is a car commercial.
And why do people get those things? Because they think they will make them happy.
Right.
They'll be happier if they don't have those things.
Well, if they focus on their own internal happiness.
Yeah.
But you can't buy.
And you're happier if you give than if you take.
Mm, that's a very good point. Yes, and it's and that de-emphasis on the material aspects and the allure to the material things.
Yeah.
Is important because it teaches, and what you are is a teacher. So you teach us to go back towards
that.
I
never think of myself as anyone teaching. I only share with people.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful because you've taught so many classes, but you've shared in so many
I think of it as sharing.
Yes. Asha, have you, in terms of your future in Ananda and the director of Ananda, you live there, of course, in your community, right?
Yes.
What is the future of Ananda? Are you, is it going to a different level or another step, or is it just to coexist in that, in the communities that you have, the future itself?
Well, last time Swami was on your show, you asked him if he was happy, and he defined happiness, true happiness, as the desire to make everyone else as happy as you are. And I thought that was wonderful because in this teaching we find so much upliftment and so much joy that there's no end to the desire to share that. So far, rather than having a 5 or a 10 year plan about we're going to do this and we're going to do that, the way Ananda has always operated is to just look for opportunities in order to share the teachings and the spirit of God that has come to us. And so we will go and do as much of that as God and our own energy allow us to do together. Once Swamiji was asked, actually by me, what is the purpose of Ananda? And Swami answered, to have fun.
Yes.
And
yes.
Everyone laughed because it seemed like such a small answer. But then he said, of course, you have to understand what we mean by fun. Fun to us is experiencing God and Divine Mother in our hearts and then sharing that
joy
with everyone.
Yes. But what happens when there's disappointments that come up? Is it just our attachment to things a certain way?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because you must understand that living in community helps you with life, but life still happens.
Yes, yes.
It's not as if you sort of enter this fantasy land. It's nothing like that. People face all the challenges, financial, health, emotional, personal. It's that this is how I felt when I met Swami Kriyananda. I felt like I finally had a center point of reality to which everything else could relate.
Mm.
And that center point was what he was just describing about we may not be able to control the world around us, but with right understanding and right practices, we can learn to keep our own consciousness where we want it to be. And then even if great difficulties and challenges come, because karmically they're destined, they may well come, we know where to stand and how to relate to them.
Mm.
And that's everything. It's not so much, yes, it's wonderful when God or Guru intervene in some way and there's a sudden and instantaneous change, but it's the everyday ability to know how to live your life in such a way that you're moving in a direct line toward ever-increasing joy. Even if sometimes scaling the mountain means you go down into the valley, there's still this sense of having a map and a direction, and that direction is our relationship to God and our inner ability to deepen that connection.
I appreciate you saying that, because life does happen. And in what I love about what you're saying is it applies to the communities that you live in, but it also has a very strong practical application. And for us to think that you live in a utopia, in a place on a cloud somewhere, which it sounds like, you know, it's a wonderful utopic society, and to say that there are still human challenges that come in, is great, because I understand that there are things that happen, life does happen, disappointments do happen, and this has a very practical application to those types of disappointments that happen. To going back to that art of happiness, to chunk up to your higher consciousness, to that place of joy.
And the waves of tests become smaller.
The waves of sense?
Tests.
Tests. Oh, they do?
They become smaller.
Really?
Because your reaction to them doesn't push them higher.
Back to the resistance conversation again. Yes, absolutely. So you're out of resistance to the things that could go wrong. Well, thank you so much for...
Well, it's been a pleasure.
...gracing me with your presence one more time, and I wish you well on your travels.
Thank you.
And if you're in Los Angeles again, let us know, but you
thank
have
you. Okay.
Served a wonderful purpose of being on the show today. And Asha, thank you so much for your clarity and the communication that you brought to Swami Kriyananda's life and exposing that to all of us. Thank you so much for bridging the gap for us. I appreciate it. And your knowledge is vast as well. So thank you very much for who you are.
Thank you for the opportunity, Lisa.
You're welcome. All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And until next time, I invite you all to stay aware.